The World Series is not over. Officially, on this episode of Baseball Barbacast, we will recap Game 4 of this Fall Classic, a game that the New York Yankees won. I can't believe it. Hello and welcome to Baseball Barbacast, the only baseball podcast in the world that knows. Before tonight, Anthony Volpe was wearing a plain white uniform, and today he earned his pinstripes. I'm Jake Mintz. That's Jordan Schusterman. The World Series rolls on.
Grand Slam in the World Series seems fun. No, it wasn't a walk-off, although I will say that Grand Slam did feel like the Yankees won the game. It was a moment that we will get into a lot later, as if you are watching on YouTube, you see Jake and I in different parts of the 200 section here at Yankee Stadium in the Bronx. I've got all the Yankee MVPs behind me. I've got Aaron Judge here right behind me. He's in the shot. He got a hit tonight later against our friend Brent. But that's good for Aaron Judge. We're not going to talk too much about him. But the Yankees won 11-4. 11 runs this Yankees offense scored. Yes, they piled on five late in the eighth. But this was a very, very impressive victory for the Yankees on a number of fronts. We are going to dive right into it. So, Jake, let's do it. Let's run through this game four that we just watched.
Now, the key to a game like this, Jordan, is taking it one day at a time. And the Yankees today thought about today. They did not think about tomorrow, allegedly, or the next day, allegedly, just today. And as will we. First inning. Actually, before the first inning, let's talk about the first pitch.
Oh, my
God. Because game three got off on the wrong foot when Fat Joe delivered a lackluster performance here at Yankee Stadium. And before game four, the bright side for the Yankees, even though they were down 3-0, was that Fat Joe would not take this field again. He would not emerge for an encore. And so there was no way that a pregame festivity could set the mood off weirdly, right? Right? Right?
Wrong.
Wrong. Paul O'Neill, a.k.a. the Warrior, a.k.a. the guy who kicked the ball that one time, a.k.a. legendary Yankees outfielder and current color commentator often, he was throwing out the first pitch to A.J. Burnett, neck tattoos and all, former Yankee hurler. And Paul O'Neill walks to the mound. And Paul O'Neill looks good still. Like he looks like a fit older guy. And he gets up on the mound and he picks up the ball and he throws it 20 feet over A.J. Burnett's head. The type of throw that the second it leaves his hand, you know it's not going anywhere near A.J. Burnett's glove.
I don't know how many people in Paul O'Neill's position before a World Series where every second counts, shouts out the bear, could you ask for a redo? How many
people? I've never seen this. Have you ever seen this? You and I have been to how many baseball games in our lives? 300? 500 games?
A lot.
How many first pitches have we seen?
Many.
Hundreds.
A first pitch.
Hundreds.
Some games have multiple first pitches, right? But the World Series first pitch, again, and this is not 50 Cent. This is a former Major League Baseball player. He soars it, and he's so embarrassed and frustrated that he asks for a redo. And it's kind of this awkward moment where it's like, is he really going to go try this again? And not only does he try it again, instead he overcompensates for air mailing it and then just spikes it, and it kind of dribbles past A.J. Burnett. And again, from before first pitch, we're already like, oh, no. Oh, gosh. And then Freddie Freeman homers again. Well, and you're like, oh, no. Oh, gosh.
I'm sorry. I need to talk more about Paul O'Neill.
Maybe he should have kicked it.
That's true. The second thing is, after he skied the first one and bounced the second one, I think the third one was going to be a perfect strike. If they had just let him do one more, he was calibrating. And I've never seen a redo, ever, first pitch. And I think it says something about Paul O'Neill that he felt compelled to do it here at the World Series of all freaking places. I think asking for a redo was the right move. that if it was a problem of execution and not concept, that if he nails the second offering down the middle, this place is going crazy. But he did not do that. And instead, this place went mild, not wild. Thank you.
Why did we have the outfielder throwing to the pitcher? Do we have an explanation for that? I guess people wouldn't have been as excited for Burnett to be throwing it. But still, I mean, you saw the risk there. That was really troubling.
Got to be all hands on deck. All right. Top of the first. Luis Gil, the walk machine on the mound for the New York Yankees. He was good in that regard tonight. He did not walk too many hitters. The second hitter of the game, however, Mookie Betts laces a double down the right field line. The Dodgers are threatening from the jump. And up walks Freddie Freeman, who had home runs in the first three games of this series. And the entire stadium is like, LOL, wouldn't it be funny if he homered? Someone was holding a sign that was on the broadcast that said, take it easy, Freddie, or what was it? It was like, please stop, Freddie. Please stop, Freddie. Yeah. Freddie did not do that.
Yeah, no, he didn't. And it was funny, after game three, Freddie had a quote that I put in my story where, of course, they're asking like, oh, someone asks, Freddie, have you understood what kind of run you're on? Like, this is so amazing. Like, do you understand that this is like a historic World Series? And he's like, I don't care if I go 0 for 70 with 70 strikeouts the rest of the way as long as we win. And instead, he hit another home run and the Dodgers found a way to lose. But Freddie keeps rolling. He hits a sinker on the outside half and just, you know, yanks it right over the short porch. Again, you give Freddie Freeman the short porch when he's this kind of locked in. I mean, it's just, it's too easy, man. I mean, he's just, and at this time, I think, again, this is the fourth home run we've now seen from Freddie Freeman in this World Series. So each one has given us a slightly different reaction, obviously, starting with that walk-off grand slam. And then he had the one against Rodon, and then he had the one in game three. And then this one, I was just kind of defeated. I was just kind of like, no, like, no way. Like, no way. Come on.
This was also the closest one. It was just a shorter version of the one from last night. And so because it was so close, there was reason to not believe in it. And then once it hit the seats, you were like, oh, well, yeah, of course, it's Freddie Freeman. So the Dodgers take a 2-0 lead. Freeman, even in a loss, keeps his World Series MVP case. Not even a case. Like, if the Dodgers win the World Series, it's Freddie Freeman. And
how does he? He could go over 70 for the rest of the way. As long as they win, he's going
to
win it.
The Yankees would have to win the World Series for Freddie Freeman to not win World Series MVP. Bottom of the first, we get another notable moment. Gleyber Torres floats one down the right field line. Mookie Betts, what a leaping catch against the wall. And then he throws the ball in, and that's the first out of the inning. We had the fan interference to end all fan interferences. As Mookie leaps up against the wall, his glove dangling over the railing, a fan in the front row grabs Mookie's glove with one hand and tries to rip the ball out of his mitt like a dog toy out of a dog's mouth. And as he's struggling to do that, his friend, presumably, would be even funnier if they were not friends and just strangers, holds Mookie Betts' throwing hand, his right hand, to prevent Mookie from getting the guy off of him. The ball eventually pops out. Mookie yells at the fan, completely understandably. Fan interference is ruled, and those two bozos are sent a-packing.
I mean, as you mentioned, it's hard to interfere more than this. Mookie makes the play, right? Sometimes this kind of play, the interference prevents the ball from being caught. But that was kind of what was so ridiculous about this, is that the play was over. Mookie had already won. And so when the fan is attempting to rip the ball out of his glove after he has already made the catch, it's just preposterous, let alone the other fan, you know, grabbing onto Mookie's hand, which, let's take a beat here to be like, this is, not only is it unacceptable and ridiculous, once a fan is actively grabbing a major leaguer in an already what is an uncomfortable position. I mean, that's dangerous bad. And terrible, right? Like, yeah. There's, of course, elements to this that is funny, undeniably, but it is, I mean, again, player safety in these very unique circumstances is very important, especially in the World Series, especially Mookie Betts, all those things apply. And while the slow-mos were patently hilarious, I mean, it was I couldn't believe it. Every time I watched it again, I was just like, how could any humans, let alone two different people at the same time, make this choice?
There was something unbelievably juvenile about the whole thing, like a kid fighting over a toy. And it was not good. And I'm happy Mookie didn't get hurt, but I'm going to watch that highlight back 1,000 more times and laugh each and every one. Yankees don't score in the first. Bottom two, we get our next big moment. Volpe is on second base after getting on and stealing second, right? And boy, oh boy, does he blunder one. Austin Wells, who has looked horrendous recently, clobbers one to deep right field, deep right center. Kike Hernandez, the center fielder for the Dodgers, ranges back, bangs up against the wall. The ball caroms off of it and rolls back towards center. Anthony Volpe is a little confused. And instead of scoring from second on a double, he only makes it to third. He ends up scoring on the next play, a grounder to first from Alex Verdugo. But there was just something about that play. You could see how visibly frustrated Volpe was. He like slapped his own leg. He was mad in the post game. He took it on himself. It was just another example of dumb base running from a Yankee team that has not played crisp. And you could squint and think that maybe there's a scenario where Wells gets a triple out of this and he scores on the out and it's a tie game and the Yankees cost themselves a run. I don't really think so. But it was just like, the Yankees just can't get out of their own way.
Yeah. And that play, again, I mean, it just looks worse and worse every time you go back and watch it. And we know there was a happy ending for Anthony Volpe. So, you know, it's not too big of a deal. But in the moment when, you know, you already had, you know, a couple base runners in the first and you don't get on and you're just like, maybe there's an opportunity for Wells could have gotten to third because he had to slow up because Volpe was just frozen basically near second base, even though Wells had smashed that ball. Not the only ball Wells would crush in this game. So again, Yankees get a run, but it's not, the vibes are not great.
And that brings us to the key moment of the game. In the bottom of the third inning, Daniel Hudson in to pitch for the Dodgers. God bless Daniel Hudson, who got the last out of the 2019 World Series. But he does not have the good stuff tonight. He hits Aaron Judge with a pitch. He allows a single to Jazz Chisholm. He walks Giancarlo Stanton. Okay. That's all after striking out Juan Soto. So there's one out. Base is loaded, one out. The noise is bopping. You can feel the balloon in this place is about to pop. The energy is going to explode. Up walks Anthony Rizzo. So Rizzo pops up, and this place lets out an enormous sigh. Just completely disheartening. Energy's gone. And with two outs, up walks Anthony Volpe. Before we talk about what that young man did here tonight, let's take a quick break. And welcome back to Baseball Barbacast. Jake Mintz, Jordan Schusterman, and the key moment of the game. If you're listening to this, you already know what happened. Anthony Volpe, first pitch slider, low and inside from Daniel Hudson, scoops it out to left field over the fence for a grand slam. And this place explodes.
I mean, this was, again, you were wondering with these games, certainly they get this weird Verdugo homer with two outs in the ninth in game three. And at that point, the crowd had, you know, dispersed. I mean, many people had already left by that point. So there wasn't even really people left to get excited. But in this case, after so many near misses, of course, not just in this game, but in the previous game, and for this, for Volpe in particular, after, of course, having that blunder earlier, and Volpe being, you know, the homegrown shortstop who grew up a Yankees fan. It's all the moments and everything you could possibly imagine. And also the payoff of someone who has, of course, had some really impressive at-bats. But it was an awesome swing and an awesome moment for sure. And obviously, you know, a lot more happens after that. But this really proved to be the difference in pretty much every sense.
The crowd pop in this place was worth the flight back from L.A., worth the ticket if you paid for one. Getting that moment, that volcanic eruption of playoff baseball joy is like why this exists. Like really, like the whole sport in a way is leading up to these moments. All the things we know about these players, their journeys, their narratives, it is so that when they get here, we can almost elevate them and celebrate them on the stage when they come through. And Volpe delivering there created something very unique specifically to him. Because as overwrought as it is, he's from around here and he grew up a Yanks fan and he loved Derek Jeter. And it means an extra level of something to Anthony Volpe. Not to say that, you know, we talk about this all the time, Jordan. I hate it when people say, oh, this team just didn't want it bad enough. Desire, when it comes to playoff baseball, is an irrelevant part of it. Everyone wants this, right? And I'm not suggesting that because Anthony Volpe grew up watching Brett Gardner play, that he deserves to hit home runs at Yankee Stadium. No. But there is like an added narrative layer because his bedroom had posters of AJ Burnett or whatever. Yeah. And it makes a moment like the one we saw tonight even richer.
Yeah, no, 100%. I mean, it was, and you could see with how everyone else reacted. Jazz talked a lot about it, how much him and Volpe have become close as they've, you know, shared the left side of the infield since he became a Yankee. And it's really something. I mean, the Volpe story, because we've watched him already be the everyday shortstop for multiple years now. I mean, it's not like we're going to stop hearing about this, because the Yankees will remain relevant regardless of how the rest of this World Series ends up. But this was a singular moment for him. As I said, too, even if the Yankees go on to lose this World Series, this is a player that is going to remain very relevant and very important. And this is going to be a highlight that he will always have, no matter what. And I think we will be revisiting many times over.
They will play it here a lot. 100%. Like, not even a question at all. And Volpe is a character in our lives. Like, you're right. He's been around so much that we forget he's still only 23. The Yankees have leaned on this guy to a historic amount in a player's first two seasons. He started 308 total games combined over his first 2 years. That is the third most ever for a player in their first two seasons. I'm not saying third most ever for a Yankee or third most ever for a shortstop or third most ever for someone from New Jersey. The third most games started in a player's first 2 years in baseball history. Two people ahead of him, Hideki Matsui, who came over here from Japan and was 29 at the time. Kind of doesn't count to me. The only one above him, in my mind, is Albert Pujols, who started more games than Volpe. He's tied with Jeff Bagwell and all these other Hall of Famers. That's not to say that he's going to have the same kind of career. It just conveys how much the Yankees trust this guy to eventually figure it out over there at shortstop. There's no backup plan. He has struggled. He has underperformed from an offensive perspective, but they believe that he is the guy and that he is the answer long term. There is no spelling him. There is no, oh, let's give this guy a shot. It's Volpe's show. And tonight, he paid the Yankees back.
Yeah. Now let's zoom back into this game, because I think one key thing, you know, we mentioned, of course, you know, Luis Gil going for the Yankees. It's the Dodgers' planned bullpen day. At the same time, you know, that didn't mean that they would necessarily punt from the beginning. And the choice to go to Daniel Hudson in the third inning was, I think, an interesting one. Now, Daniel Hudson, of course, has been a very important reliever for them when he's been healthy, but he was not one of their necessarily best relievers down the stretch. And he has certainly, you know, had some interesting appearances this postseason as well. But he was the choice there after Ben Kasparis, who had opened, to face the middle of the order. And as you saw for the rest of this game, this was kind of a theme. Dave Roberts had a plan and he really stuck to it. It wasn't a situation where as soon as someone was in trouble, oh, you started seeing movement in the bullpen. Whoever was coming in, like, those were their innings. And that was the case for Hudson, as he was clearly struggling in that inning. I mean, he got, again, we're talking, yes, he strikes out Soto, but then, you know, he hits Judge, Jazz singles, we mentioned Stanton walk. Like, it wasn't looking great, you know, before Volpe kind of popped him on that first pitch. But that's just kind of who they decided to go with, and that was kind of a theme throughout the rest of the night.
And an important takeaway, the Dodgers don't use any of their A relievers. They don't use any of the
Hudson
top guys
yet. Was, in theory, one of them, although he's kind of fallen down that order. And of course, that was the plan, because ultimately after Hudson, we get four innings of Landon Knack. And listen, I know he gives up a rocket to Austin Wells late, but Landon Knack did his job, man. Landon Knack, he was the one that a lot of people were doubting in this role. I know that a lot of people wanted to see Brent Honeywell in some form, and we did, and we know it didn't go well. But Landon Knack looked good, man. I mean, he, yeah, again, like that homer to Wells was big, and at the time, that felt like a pretty significant insurance run. Obviously, it didn't feel like it ended up meeting quite as much. But Knack was good. Two hits over those four innings. You got to give him credit. And to your point, they didn't use the main guys, which obviously Roberts was very, you know, straightforward about even before the game.
Yeah. Dave Roberts didn't use Michael Kopech, didn't use Alex Vesia, didn't use Blake Treinen. These are the guys who've been throwing.
Bruce Starr
did not throw. These are the guys who've been throwing the highest leverage innings for them.
Bonda's pitched in like every game. Yeah, we didn't see him. So
that is relevant just as we fold into tomorrow. And let's kind of move forward in the ball game. It does stay close because it's only a 5-2 lead after Volpe hits the grand slam. Will Smith hits a solo shot in the top of the fifth, 5-3. Dodgers get another run after a challenge on a double play. It's 5-4. And Luis Gil gets pulled after walking Edmund in the fifth. The Dodgers are into the Yankees bullpen. And the Dodgers are a hit away multiple points from taking the lead or tying the ball game. It's still tense. Fast forward to bottom six. Austin Wells gives a little bit of breathing room with a solo home run to right field. He knew he got it. Kind of pimped it a little bit. A little bit of sauce. Good for Austin Wells. Crushed two baseballs tonight after looking abysmal for the better part of 3 weeks.
Yeah, the choice to put Wells back in the lineup, I think, was a matter of, listen, like, I know that he's had some brutal at-bats and he's looked overmatched, but the offensive ceiling for him is obviously so much higher than anything Trevino can do. And you saw that on those swings tonight with the double. You saw that with the home run. And I said, as soon as we sat down in our press box seats before game three, I said, we have an incredible angle for home runs to right field. And we had it on Freddie's, but this Wells one with the bat flip was just perfect.
The next big moment in this game comes in the seventh, where Mark Leiter Jr. is in, and he gets Will Smith to start the frame, but then he walks Tommy Edman. Don't walk Tommy Edman. Okay? If Tommy Edman
happening.
Is hitting
People
lefty,
walking. Yeah.
Don't walk Tommy Edman, because you know who hits after Tommy Edman? Shohei Ohtani. Tommy Edman's still second, and Ohtani's up as the tying run. And you're like, oh boy, is this it? Is he going to deliver? And Leiter strikes Ohtani out. Incredibly impressive. Great example of what we talk about with platoon advantages. Leiter throws a bunch of pitches that go the other way, away from a left-handed batter, even though Leiter is a right-handed thrower. And that is what helps him get Ohtani. The two-way superstar strikes out swinging on a splitter down in the zone. And you're like, okay, Yankees might actually win themselves a baseball game. But first, they have to get out Mookie Betts, and that's not going to be Mark Leiter Jr.'s job. Because in comes the Dream Weaver, Yankee closer Luke Weaver, on in the seventh to get Betts. And boy, does he get him.
Yeah, so he strikes out Mookie and then, you know, comes back out. And, I mean, talk about key moments of the game. I mean, the game is still tight enough here. Bottom of the seventh, the Yankees go down 1-2-3, Judge, Jazz, and Stanton. And with Freddie, Teoscar, and Muncy coming up, I mean, all right, we keep watching Luke Weaver like, man, can he keep doing this? This is the seventh time this postseason that Luke Weaver has been asked to get more than three outs. And he does it. You know, he strikes out Teoscar, he strikes out Muncy, he gets Freddie to fly out. And, I mean, Weaver has just been unbelievable. And we should note here that from what we could tell, Luke Weaver would have pitched the ninth inning had Brent Honeywell not given up a million runs in the eighth. Like, there was nobody warming, and, like, Weaver said afterwards, like, I was ready to throw three, I was ready to throw four, whatever. And that was clearly the plan. They were just going to ride Weaver all the way to the end. And, you know, at that point, it would have been the bottom of the Dodgers order. But he's just been so, so, so impressive. And I thought that was absolutely huge.
Friend of the show, Brent Honeywell, comes in for the bottom of the eighth inning. And we won't go beat by beat because it did not go well.
No, it didn't. But I will say, he did make history. We have confirmation on this, Jake.
Yeah.
And it bums me out because it didn't go well. But he did throw more pitches in that inning than anyone has ever thrown in a single inning since they track pitches in an inning or less in the postseason.
In the postseason, not the World Series.
Postseason.
Oof.
One inning or fewer, 50 pitches. And, you know, obviously this is in some ways, unfortunately, course, he pitched better earlier in the postseason. But the point is that Brent was going to be the last pitcher no matter what. And unfortunately, this was the worst version of that. I mean, there was some weird plays early in it where, you know, they tried to get an out at home and the Lux didn't have a good throw home. And then it really just unraveled from there with the Kleber homer and Judge and Soto getting hits. And yeah, no, it sucked to watch, obviously, because we care about Brent. Still cool to see him pitch in the World Series after all that he's been through.
Yeah.
But, you know, obviously not super fun for us.
Not to like inundate everybody with Brent Honeywell focused content, but I hope that it is instructive in a way of the multitude of stories that exist at a World Series.
Yeah.
Right. I don't think I've said Juan Soto's name yet today in this episode, but like,
well, he didn't do anything until he
didn't really do
off.
Anything today.
Yeah.
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 Brent Honeywell matters to us and matters to people who know Brent Honeywell, but each of these teams has like seven Brent Honeywells in a way. And also there's only one Brent Honeywell. And so to watch someone that we care about go out there in the World Series and get bombed was not fun. However, I guarantee you it will not change the way Brent Honeywell goes about his business. Tim Mesa comes on for the ninth and gets 1-2-3 inning. And the Yankees win. They play New York, which they play when they lose too, which always makes me laugh. And they slap hands and they live to fight another day as the Yankees take this one 11-4 over the Dodgers.
We are going to take one more break. And when we return, we will look ahead. Game 5 here in the Bronx, Gerrit Cole, Jack Flaherty, Part 2. We'll be right back.
This is a series again, and that is my takeaway from tonight. That even if the Dodgers roll out tomorrow and pulverize the Yankees and win the World Series, tonight gave us the possibility of tension, gave us a crowd pop at Yankee Stadium. It gave us the opportunity to think about what this series could be if the Yankees continue to battle their way back into it, and I am very thankful for that. But one of the images for me that will endure in my mind from Game 4 is the clubhouse after the game. Most of the people had filed out, and Gerrit Cole is long gone, right? Like, he's one of the first dudes out. He's starting tomorrow. He's probably asleep by the time I leave the clubhouse. But in front of his locker is his chair, and on top of his chair is his glove, perched as a reminder to all of us of who Game 5 truly belongs to. It is going to be the type of night where we look back on Gerrit Cole and we say, remember when he did this? Or remember when he did that? It is a chance, an opportunity for him to ascend to a higher level of ball player. He is already one of the best five pitchers in the game. But if Gerrit Cole wants to be remembered as one of the greats, yeah, he's going to be a Hall of Famer, whether he throws 1 or 9 tomorrow. But tomorrow is going to really shape the way we think about Gerrit Cole moving forward. And I can't freaking wait.
Yeah, I mean, again, when you have a pitcher of his caliber and his story, no matter what it is, whether it's setting the tone in Game 1, which he did, and they still lost, you know, think about his World Series experience previously. You go back to 2019, now that was a little bit different because when he was pitching for Houston, they had home field advantage. He also pitched Games 1 and Game 5. He lost Game 1. He wasn't as good. He was awesome in Game 5 in Washington to put Houston up 3-2. That will not be the case
against Joe Ross.
Yes, that is true. But Gerrit Cole was awesome, regardless of who was pitching on the other side. And now in that case, of course, that was to put his team up 3-2. In this case, he is trying to get his team to be down 3-2, but send it back to Los Angeles. And yeah, no, I agree. That's Game 5 is the Gerrit Cole game. It is an opportunity. It's an opportunity for Jack Flaherty too. You know, Jack Flaherty has basically alternated gems and stinkers this postseason. And I guess if you go by that, he's probably not going to do very well in Game 5, but he can prove us wrong, right? Of course, he'll be on the road here and maybe it will go poorly. But I agree. Cole is, of course, the first thing you're thinking of. And I would say, in terms of other things that you know the Yankees can hopefully carry over into Game 5, you just hope that some of that bottom of the order production sustains, right? I mean, if you're getting stuff from Volpe and you're getting stuff from Wells, that's a huge deal because it wasn't a great night for Soto. And it wasn't a great night for Stanton or for Judge even. You know, still looking a little bit better, but still missing pitches and still not necessarily impacting the game in a real way. And so if you can get real production from Wells and Volpe, because Verdugo's putting the ball in play when he needs to, and credit to him, but Rizzo's a tough watch right now. And so I don't know if they're, and Jan's starting to look a little bit better. So, you know, there's parts of that Yankees lineup that gives you hope that especially if Flaherty's a little bit shaky, you know, they can make this interesting.
Do you remember how I finished the show yesterday when I said that Yankee hitters not named Juan Soto or Giancarlo Stanton are hitting 143, 231, 157 in the World Series so far? That number certainly went up today.
Yeah, no, absolutely. And, you know, Wells in particular, right, just to remind, because it's not just that, I mean, there's just been no thump. The power has not been there, even for Volpe, right? Like, Volpe's been putting together some good at-bats and then, you know, dumping a single into right or, you know, drawing a bunch of walks. Like, that's not that that's not helpful, but none of these guys scare you, right? But then you see that swing that Wells puts on a ball reminds you that he's capable of that and why we've been so high on him all season. That's what's really encouraging, and I think what you really have to hang on to, because ultimately, you know, the Dodgers offense, and this is a credit to the Yankees pitching, right? That's the other thing that you have to take away from this, is that the Yankees arms once again showed up in a huge way. Can they do it again? They just, again, you know, 24 hours later, can they do it again up against a rested Dodgers bullpen? I think that's obviously the other matchups watching Game 5.
Last night, the combined OPS for those other Yankee hitters was under 400. Tonight, it is at 631. Now, yes, it is all small sample size, but they are crawling their way back to being good enough. Just one more thing on Flaherty. Watch the velocity in the first inning for him, because he starts NLCS Game 1 and is amazing against the Mets. Comes out in Game 5, and the velo's down from the jump, and they blast him. So if he's out there tomorrow throwing 90 in the first inning, it might be a long day for Flaherty.
Yeah, and while he had that one mistake to Stanton, I mean, he was really good in Game 1. Now, it's going to be a little bit colder here. It's, of course, going to be more of a hostile environment, but this is a big one for Flaherty, too. Of course, as he kind of his, you know, his last start of the season. I mean, I don't see a scenario where he's pitching again after this. I guess Game 7 relief, maybe. But for a guy entering free agency and has had such a fascinating career who's still only, 28, 29, this is also a pretty big stage for Flaherty at this point. But I agree. Gerrit Cole is absolutely what I'll be thinking about when I'm going to bed. And I'm excited. I will say that, you know, coming to the ballpark today, it was a little bit hard to get amped. Of course, we're so lucky we get to cover this World Series, regardless of what the series score is or whatever. But it'll certainly have a different energy coming here for Game 5.
One more thing. Shohei Ohtani, shoulder, no visible signs of discomfort today, as far as I could tell. He hit a ball 103.8 miles an hour, which is notable. Not as hard as he can hit it, as he has hit it, I think, 118 this postseason. But doesn't look hurt. Like, he's definitely hurt, right? But today he looked Ohtani-y enough when he hit that ball.
Yeah, and he wasn't running quite as... He did have a play where he was holding it up when he was running, but... Yeah, he did not seem to be, again, we're like super hyper analyzing. I mean, maybe he felt exactly the same as Game 3. Who's to say? But he's obviously still someone that we are waiting, if we are going to have one more moment for him, especially on the road. And of course, the injury is a part of that narrative. But Freddie's going to, you know, Freddie is still the one, of course, we are focusing on for the Dodgers the rest of the way.
Last Judge thing. Talking about Judge right now and how he looks reminds me of when I had like god awful COVID in 2021 and couldn't taste or smell anything, and you would ask me how I was doing, and I'd be like, I'm a little bit better today, a little bit better today. How you feeling? Oh, like, yeah, I could taste the salt in that. And you'd be like, okay, good. Like that, we're talking about Judge like he has a cold or the flu. It's like, is he okay? Like, oh yeah, well, he's feeling better.
But are you suggesting it's still not great. He still isn't better, right? Again, like, I know he had, he didn't strike out tonight.
That's great. Thank you to Andrew Hartz.
Raise the banner for your Yankee fan, Andrew Hartz. That's it. That's a good note to end on. You can email us, baseballbarbercast@gmail.com. Aaron Judge, he's right behind me on the wall of Yankee MVP winners, and he didn't strike out once. Throw the parade for that. Thank you all for listening. Thank you to producer Andrew Hartz for staying up late and making this show possible. Thank you for everyone who has been enjoying these postseason pods. How many more will we have? Who's to say?
Here's my one wish, and I'll leave you with this. Our Volpe crowd pop tonight was great. I don't care who wins this thing, but I would love a Judge early game bomb tomorrow. One for the road. Thanks, everyone.
Bye.